afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is March 12th, 2023, and my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. If you're looking for John Deere products, go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go.
And in honor of my my vision that will be greatly improved here soon.
Yeah.
It's not done improving. Still got a little ways to go. But Shasta Eye Medical Group. Yeah, got to throw out a free ad for them. So if you...
Well, you can't take it back.
I guess I vote aye, huh?
Yeah.
I guess my job prospects are limited. So I guess I'm Aaron with one eye. Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah, so cataract surgery, isn't it great? I thought I'd get to all the senior citizen stuff kind of at the front end of being a senior citizen, like before I really qualify for the discounts and stuff like that. Just wanted to, you know, take care of the gallbladder, the cataract surgery, and all that. I'm going to skip Alzheimer's and some of those other things because they're kind of problematic. I'm going to avoid all of that. But anyway, Shasta Eye Medical Group. I'll tell you what, it's kind of amazing. All the people who have had cataract surgery are like, oh, we already knew. But for everyone else, seriously, you go in there, you're there for like an hour and a half, but the surgery takes 10 minutes. I don't understand how they can cut your eye open, take the lens out, put a new one in, get it all done, and poof, there you go. So anyway, I'm looking forward to being able to see things again. It's going to be a great day. So will I... Can't see things again all that well yet, just because I have a little blurry medication trying to work its way through my eye. You'll have to pardon me, but I wanted to introduce our first guest. We've got two different people today, which is kind of nice. A little switch it up here. Two different topics, two different people. And so our guest is Mark Moyer, and he is the William P. Harris Chair in Military History at Hillsdale College and the author of a new book called Triumph Regained, the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1968. His past academic appointments include the Kim T. Adamson Chair of the Insurgency and Terrorism at the U.S. Marine Corps University and fellowships at the Joint Special Operations University and Texas A&M. Go Texas! Hi to my brother. Yeah, he's a frequent media guest who's appeared on all sorts of major radio. Well, that would be here, of course, and television programs nationwide. During the Trump administration, he served in the U.S. Agency for International Development as the director of the Office of Civilian Military Cooperation. He's the author of six previous books on military history, diplomatic history, grand strategy, leadership, and international development. He's also written articles for the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. So I think he also has his BA from Harvard and a PhD from Cambridge, so University of Cambridge. So I guess he's pretty much qualified to talk about all this, and we're just going to ride along.
Not really a slacker or anything.
No, as our parents would have said back in the day, he applied himself. That was always the goal, was to apply yourself. I'm not sure that's a thing anymore, but it was good for all of us.
So we're here to talk about his new book, The Vietnam War, Triumph Regained, The Vietnam War, 1965 through 1968. I read a little bit about it, and I'm curious what made you want to write this book?
Yeah, it's great to be here with you. Thanks. Well, I started actually working on the Vietnam War about 30 years ago as a college student, and it came as a great surprise to me. I didn't have anyone in my family in Vietnam, but I met some Vietnam veterans, and they were so different from the stereotypes you see on the media of these disheveled, disgruntled,
right,
you know, homeless, et cetera, et cetera. And so I started, and I was a bit interested in history, but to get into Vietnam, I started to see that the whole narrative we've been given through mainstream media and academia was just false in so many ways. And I wrote a couple previous books on Vietnam. The last one went sort of covers up to the U.S. getting in the war, but this one, 65 to 68, I found just as much that really will overturn most of what people think they know about Vietnam.
Yeah, it's the narrative hasn't really changed a lot since then, and I agree with you. It's not really been correct, and maybe we can back up just a little bit and talk about, you know, why did we go to war in Vietnam? Maybe we can start at the beginning.
Yeah, well, it's generally understood that America went into Vietnam to stop the spread of communism. Now, the standard narrative would tell you that this was anti-communist hysteria and there was no need to be afraid of communism. And there's evidence they point to the fact that after the war in 75, most of these domino countries don't fall. But as I point out in this book, communist countries were actually on the march in 1965, and it's only what happens in Vietnam that actually prevents them from taking over Southeast Asia. And in particular, in Indonesia, there's a monumental confrontation in the fall of 65 between the communists and the anti-communists. And the anti-communists prevail, and they credit their victory to the American stand in Vietnam because it convinced them that the United States was committed to Asia and would help them and was not going to bail out.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, other common knowledge is we got into Vietnam to, we were attacked, of course, first, but we helped bail out the French who were getting it handed to them over there. Is that true?
You know, French, they are fighting in the 50s, and we give them a lot of aid, but then they want us to bail them out at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and President Eisenhower decides not to intervene there, but basically to support a divided Vietnam. And we do support a government that actually proves to be pretty effective, and they're fighting against Ho Chi Minh, who is somebody who's been idolized and misrepresented. That's another one of the big myths of Vietnam, that Ho Chi Minh was just a nationalist who we didn't really need to fight. But the truth is he really was a sort of dyed-in-the-wool Marxist-Leninist who was committed to international revolution and was only going to be stopped by force.
Mm-hmm. And what was the status of the war when we actually got involved? What was going on at that time?
Well, there's limited support under Eisenhower, and then Kennedy increases support to Vietnam, but at that point it's just a low-level insurgency. And then there's a coup right before Kennedy's assassinated. We support the assassination of South Vietnam's president, which is a huge mistake. And that leads to a downward spiral and a succession of coups and purges, and then a North Vietnamese invasion the beginning of 65. So this book picks up in the middle of 65 when President Johnson decides he's got to put American troops in because otherwise South Vietnam is going to fall.
Mm-hmm. And that, it's my understanding that Johnson didn't really pay attention to his leaders, his generals on the ground, and that's kind of what got us into trouble over there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one of the main themes of the book, is that early on the American generals realized that the way that Johnson wanted to fight the war was not going to be something that would be easy to sustain with the American people. And so they keep telling him, look, we're playing defense we're just fighting in South Vietnam. The North Vietnamese can just keep sending troops down here. And we're killing a lot of them, but they can just keep coming. So we need to go someplace else. We need to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. We need to step up the bombing. And the bombing campaign was conceived by Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. And he had this idea of gradual escalation, which is borrowed from abstract economic thinking, which was sort of divorced from reality. But thinking was that, well, if we just slowly increase the bombing, we will give ourselves better negotiating power. But it turns out we sent all the wrong signals, and this suggests to the North Vietnamese we were weak. And so the generals are constantly pleading to intensify the bombing. It does happen once in the fall of 67, and Hanoi is brought near this brink of starvation, but then Lyndon Johnson takes his foot off the gas pedal, and the North Vietnamese are able to recover.
Mm. What was China? What was China's role at that time?
Well, that's an interesting question. So China, in 1965, they are at the forefront of communist revolution, and that's one of the reasons why it's imperative that the U.S. goes in. Now, by the time you get to the end of the war, it's very different. China is not aggressively pushing for revolution, and they're, in fact, at odds with the North Vietnamese, who used to be their allies. And Vietnam did a lot to contribute to this because, for one thing, it required the Soviets to give more aid, and that upset the Chinese. And then the Chinese get frustrated in Vietnam, and Mao launches his proletarian cultural revolution, where they start killing people for all sorts of trivial offenses, and sort of decimates their economy, decimates their military, so that by 75, China no longer is this threat to Asia that it had been.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think the turning point was? I mean, once we got involved, I mean, you know, we had this gradual escalation, but we weren't really achieving much. Was it because we didn't have clear goals, or was it just a leadership issue?
Well, the single biggest turning point was this coup in 1963, where we helped the assassination of South Vietnamese president Ngo Dinh Diem. And then from then on, years are needed to rehabilitate the South Vietnamese government. And they will ultimately get rehabilitated by the late 60s. And they're able to defend themselves against a big invasion in 1972. But the American people run out of patience. And ultimately, and partly because of Watergate, they decide, Congress decides to pull the plug on our allies, and leads to, you know, ignominious withdrawal.
Mm. Why do you think there was such a negative public consensus of the war? I mean, it seemed like there was from the very beginning. The American people just never really got behind it.
Well, that's a good question, too. And one thing that I found in doing the research is actually public opinion is more supportive overall than we've generally been led to believe. But the vocal minority ended up writing the history and tried to portray things as if the American people were more against the war than they were. Now there is, though, a lot of disenchantment because a lot of the people think the war is being fought the wrong way, and particularly with respect to how the bombing is going, and it's understood at the time. So you have a lot of people getting upset about that, and then you also have to reckon with the fact that Lyndon Johnson studiously avoids explaining the war to the American people, and he's often getting told by his confidants, you need to go out and sell the war, you need to be a real wartime president like Franklin Roosevelt was, explain what's going on. But he refused to do that, and his reasoning was that he wanted to be a domestic president who was going to be known for civil rights and the Great Society programs that were supposed to end poverty. And he believed that if he riled people up about the war, that they wouldn't pay enough attention to his domestic agenda. But towards the end of his presidency, he even admits that was a mistake on his part.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that, in hindsight, bad call. Keeping everybody in the dark doesn't usually actually turn out all that good. We have to take a really quick break. We will be right back with our guest, Mark Moyer. He is the author of Triumph Regained. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Never been lonely, never been lied to, never had so many fear, nothing you'd like to. Born at the end of the church bell chime, home always spread, born at the right.
Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. So Johnson should have pitched the war because, well, TV was new. I mean, the mechanisms for government to get the word out were kind of limited to TV and radio at that time. But he didn't.
Yes, that's right.
He didn't take advantage of any of that.
That is correct, and you know, the TV was still relatively new at that point, and he did occasionally give a press conference, but it was really, I think, irresponsible, and did a great disservice to all the people who were over there. And of course, one of the other bad effects that we get out of Vietnam is that a lot of people blame the troops for things happening there when it really was Johnson, and that was part of probably his rationale too, is he didn't want to take ownership of something because he knew it would be difficult and messy.
Yeah, and I think after, we had the Korean conflict, which ended in pretty much a stalemate, which really didn't go well with, I think, a lot of people. And then we jumped into Vietnam, and that turned into a kind of a political football right away. And so that, you know, that wasn't really a good thing, I think, in the eyes of the American people. One of the things that you mentioned was how you were able to write this book with the influence of information that you got from the North Vietnamese. How did that come about?
Yes, I met a former government translator who was fluent in Vietnamese, and he also was able to track down a bunch of information that the Vietnamese government had sort of quietly put out. Now, they've never opened their archives because they're still the police state, but they have released some documents, and they've also, a number of their leaders have published memoirs. So we know a lot more than we did back in the day, and the Chinese have also published some information, partly because of this falling out that they have with the Vietnamese, and they want to some extent embarrass the Vietnamese. But it really changes how we view the war, because much of what happened was there was great controversy over how the U.S. was actually doing in the war. General Westmoreland, American commander, was routinely accused of being hopelessly optimistic and exaggerating the successes of the American troops. Well, now we can tell with a good degree of certainty from these North Vietnamese accounts that, in fact, the North Vietnamese were devastated by American military operations, and that the American military was as effective as General Westmoreland was saying. Now, again, of course, they were able to still keep sending more troops down south. That also, you know, this also puts it in a new light, because if you think the United States were ever in a war and we just kept sending huge numbers of troops to get massacred by a stronger enemy, we would eventually say, you know, we've got to do something different. We got to change our president. But they're in a dictatorship, and you know, Ho Chi Minh actually is sort of on the outs by the time the U.S. gets in. And a man named Lê Duẩn, who comes in, and he is told consistently by his own subordinates that what he's doing is not working, but he just keeps, you know, it's a bit like the football coach who's keeps running the same play even though it fails every time. And so they took horrific losses, but this Lê Duẩn had sort of maniacal desire and was willing to sacrifice huge numbers of his people.
So with that information, how close to actually winning that war were we? And maybe we didn't even know it.
You know, there were a couple key points. Now, I think if we had actually not supported this coup in 63, we might never have needed to send troops in the first place. Then there's a number of instances in 64, 65, the generals are telling Johnson he has to, you know, demonstrate resolve and act forcefully, and he's in the middle of a presidential campaign. He refuses to do that, and that then encourages the North Vietnamese to step things up. Then you get to 1967. There's this bombing that is bringing Hanoi to starvation, and had that been continued, there's, I think, a good chance that could have led to a peace settlement. And then there's also the, you know, the opportunities missed to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which are the infiltration lines in Laos. And the generals on the U.S. side kept calling for this, and Secretary of Defense McNamara and others were claiming, no, no, this isn't going to help that much. Well, we hear now from the North Vietnamese that, in fact, yes, they viewed that as the most dire threat. And you know, had we cut that infiltration route, they would have been wouldn't be able to supply the troops in the south. They could have tried to keep fighting, but it'd be more like the Korean War, which would be a lot harder for them to fight because they couldn't hide behind the population. And you did mention, you know, Korea was not very popular at the time, but we do see that it ultimately leads to this great success of South Korea, which is, you know, now one of the most, you know, economically strong countries in the world. And I think we could have done the same in South Vietnam. But the fact that we are able to preserve most of these countries in Asia is, in fact, relevant still today, because our number one adversary in the world today is China. And had we bailed out of Vietnam in 1965, I think you would have seen most, if not all, of Asia under some form of government that was loyal to or obedient to China, and we'd be in a much tougher place right now.
Mm-hmm. And so Operation Rolling Thunder, that was the big campaign, and that had devastating effects on the North Vietnamese. Was that could that have been a major turning point, or was it a major turning point for North Vietnam?
Yeah, it could have been in, you know, earlier on, as I mentioned, that the generals are really pushing to get this going harder. Anyway, it will get curtailed later on. Johnson never really pushes it to maximum effect. And then we see when Richard Nixon comes in, he will actually step up the bombing, and it will prove very useful because he's less interested in these academic theories, and he knows that if you really hit the enemy hard, that's what's going to get them to negotiate. And that was another mistake of the Johnson administration, was they had this idea that if we want to negotiate, if we want the enemy to negotiate with us, we have to back off because we don't want to provoke them. Well, and now seeing what the North Vietnamese say, well, it's the exact opposite. The only way they are going to negotiate is if they're hurting, if they, by continuing to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're seeing a little of that today. Let's all be best friends and see how that works out. It's like that's not really how those countries. It's not how a lot of our adversarial countries view that.
Yeah, that's right. They have, you know, we tend to, at least some people in our country have very naive notions about how you deal with, you know, dictators and. You know, they don't think the same way we do, and what we think is, you know, a goodwill gesture, they tend to think is a sign of weakness, and
right.
So you make a mistake if you try to treat them the same way you would want to deal with them, you know, another American or Westerner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they talk about the agreements that we make, like with China and some of them, and, you know, the climate things and all that. And we sign these agreements that are binding on us, and the other countries are like, wow, it sucks to be you. we're super not doing any of that.
Yes, we tend to be naive, and we also have this tendency to think that just the act of negotiating is somehow meaningful. And we also get played for suckers on that a lot, too, because these countries will say, okay, we'll agree to talk with you only if you meet certain conditions. So we make a concession just to talk, and then they go on doing what they were going to do anyway, and they now have a concession from us, and they refuse to actually reach any sort of agreement of the sort we were hoping for.
Yeah,
we read into what talking was all about. For them, talking was just to take us off the playing field, and so they could make a run for it.
So
and then it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling, then you become obsessed with just having a deal, no matter how bad it is, because you want to show something came out of it, so you agree to almost anything the enemy wants.
Yeah, even if they don't live up to it,
so,
we look at it as victory.
Yeah, and I'm thinking as we're talking about this, so I don't know if this was the point of you writing this, but I think that one of the benefits of writing about these things, obviously history has huge value, but writing about this type of thing now, it's like, hey, people who are dealing with this kind of thing now, would you please read this book? There's some secret insight in here for you that might ring true.
Yeah, there's a lot you can learn. And one of the problems we have today with our foreign policy is that most colleges don't even teach the history of warfare anymore. And where I'm at Hillsdale, we actually are increasing what we do, but a lot of people have decided they don't want to worry about that, and there's a certain hubris that we don't have anything to learn from the past because we're smarter than those other people, were. But, history has a way of, biting people who don't pay attention to it.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that did come out of the war was our ability to slow down or stop the communist advancement in Asia. Do you feel that was probably one of the major impacts of the war? Was our ability to stop that communist movement? And even today, I think don't we have some benefit from that?
Yeah, that's right, and that's one of the biggest, I think, myths of Vietnam is that it was just a total strategic disaster. But in fact, we achieved our main strategic objective, which is to stop the spread or contain communism, because it said we only, after Vietnam falls, you don't lose most of the other countries. Well, you do lose Cambodia, and 2 million people get murdered there by the Khmer Rouge, which is something that also people kind of slough off, but not to be trifled with. And I do certainly think we should have stayed with South Vietnam, because by the time we give up on them, we don't even have troops there. They're able to sustain themselves if we can give them the resources. There's some people who want to use this against Nixon. And there's also, again, a fair amount of naivete about, a lot of people think, well, we can, if we actually help our ally too much, that this will provoke the enemy. And so we shouldn't help them too much, which, again, also is something we're seeing in the debates over Ukraine. We tend to oftentimes be so concerned about who we provoke that we let them take advantage of us.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good point. I mean, the South Vietnamese, I think one of the things people don't consider is they were fighting and were able to defend themselves when we pulled out, and had we just given them some support, it may have turned out different. But when we pulled out, we pulled all our support, everything out, and just left them to swing in the wind. And
thanks for the help. See ya.
Yeah, and so I think that wasn't that one of the major reasons it collapsed so quickly?
Yes, because they had, I said, they've really gotten better by the 70s, and the Americans who were in Vietnam are saying, we just need to kind of keep up the level of military support that we've promised them, and they should be okay. And but Congress ignores them, the Congress that comes in and is pushing on Watergate, and they see this as a way to hurt Nixon, and they've also bought off on a lot of the false notions about Vietnam, that somehow the communists aren't that bad, and that they have, there was an idea at the time that the communists in South Vietnam were independent of those in the North and were sort of a grassroots movement. But that's another thing that North Vietnamese sources have made very clear, that there was never an independent movement. They tried to make it look like there was this independent movement for propaganda reasons, and some naive people in other countries believed them, but it was always one conflict.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, the propaganda always gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why the countries that are good at it sometimes get a leg up on us a little bit. I was, I don't know if we want to take a break early and so we don't blow it up, but I was really curious about the one thing we had listed here, the domestic politics and American public opinion. connected to the conduct of the war, because that was a biggie. And I'm curious, in your historical view of things, how big of a factor was that? Because, I mean, I was a kid, so, but, like, I don't know, Bill's dad was a cop then, you know, tangled in all the riots and all that stuff. I mean, it was a very contentious period. How about when we come back, we look at that, because there are a lot of us who are seeing this through the lens of either not being born yet or were children at that time. But a lot of the protesters are running our government, so I guess it's kind of important to know what they were up to.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be right if we didn't play War by the Temptations, because, well, it's just
right.
We got to do that. So we'll be right back with our guest, Mark Moyer, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Yeah, that's the true test. Got to teach them about it. So the domestic politics and all the stuff that was going on at home, in your research, what did you find anything new and different about that, or was it just like it looked like it appears that it was just anarchy and craziness? And
yeah, well, there was a sizable part of population that was really strongly behind the war, that was underappreciated, and there was, you know, we mostly hear today about these anti-war protesters, but they were actually they were small at the time, and they were not well liked by most of the American people. And you have to remember that there was a draft at that time, so, you know, most Americans knew somebody who was in Vietnam, and they wanted to support the war because the troops were there, and they were appalled by the draft dodgers who were going after and criticizing the troops, criticizing the war. Another interesting thing I found was that in college campuses, the war is actually not unpopular at the beginning. There's this, people think, oh, well, yeah, the college kids were always against it. But in fact, it's not until the middle of 1967 that the college campuses turned against the war. And one thing I found, which people really have for the most part ignored, is, you know, why is it that all of a sudden college campuses are full of protests about the Vietnam War? Well, in the summer of 67, the government changed the draft rules, and they got rid of a lot of the exemptions for students to go to that they would get if they went to graduate school. And you therefore suddenly have students being outraged, but it's clearly a question of self-preservation rather than any sort of, you know, concern about what's actually happening in Vietnam. And
it wasn't a policy decision.
Yeah, it's and, you know, we also see later when Nixon ends the draft that suddenly the protests die down. So, you know, a lot of the people who have tried to shape the narrative of the war tried to claim that this was all idealistic and they were just appalled at what the United States was doing in Vietnam. But in fact, for many of them, it was just, you know, they didn't want to get drafted. And this is the, you know, baby boom generation, or the me generation, who, you know, was raised by the greatest generation, who, you know, for whom patriotic sacrifice was the norm. But, you know, this was the most pampered generation in history, and they were you know, many of them were not interested in, you know, going to serve in the military. And, but, you know, once they didn't want to do that, then, you know, they couldn't really admit that there was anything good in Vietnam. It had to be a bad war, because that's the only way you can kind of justify dodging the draft, is if you say, well, aha, this was a bad war, and therefore there's nothing wrong with protesting and turning against it, dodging the draft.
It's funny how that works. You can, you know, revise that to your satisfaction until you get to where you want to go. So that kind of explains why a lot of these people, a lot of the ones we're dealing with now that are creating bad policy, have so many degrees. They spent a lot of time amassing advanced degrees, and that was their way of getting out of serving.
Yes, and it also, you know, helped produce this strange self-righteousness we see from a lot of these people, that, you know, they become sort of, I think they, to some extent, have lied to themselves, but they are kind of oblivious to this, and so they have a sort of terrible self-righteousness, which, you know, bleeds over, of course, into other, you know, aspects of life, and we see, you know, we continue to see it today where, you know, people are so self-righteous that they think anybody who disagrees with them must be, you know, crazy, or
yeah.
You know, we have this problem of people unable to talk with people who disagree with them, which I think is one of our biggest problems.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, why would we want to sort through the issues? It's. I realize I'm sort of skipping around a little bit, but your first book was Triumph Forsaken, and so I have a note here from your publicist that said it created quite a stir, and one of the things he said, you might want to ask him if his academic career suffered because you challenged the prevailing orthodoxy. I was kind of curious about that when I saw the title of your book. I thought, I wonder how this wonder how this landed.
Yeah, you know, that's another legacy of the Vietnam War, is that you have these baby boomers who protest against the war. They end up becoming professors, and mm-hmm. you know, there are a lot of boomers who do go to Vietnam. It's not like everybody's dodging the draft, but very few of them actually become college professors, and they're kind of shunned when they come back. So, and there is this strongly entrenched interest in the anti-war narrative, and certainly questioning that was not something that many of them welcomed. And we have, as I'm sure you know, in general, this gross ideological imbalance on our college campuses. And, you know, my viewpoint was, and people who support the war is actually, you know, Vietnam veterans, if you talk to them as a whole, they are, most of them have been very supportive of my work, but they, you know, they don't feel they've been properly represented in the media or academia.
No, they were brutally maligned, and wrongly so.
Yeah, so, but that view, yes, is very much unpopular in academia. And the, you know, there was a survey, because this also tends to not entirely translate along political lines, but sort of the conservatives have always been more supportive of the Vietnam War than others. And so, you know, conservatives at my alma mater, Harvard, in the last, there was a survey done there, only 1% of the faculty at Harvard were considered themselves to be conservative. And that's, you know, I can tell you that's no coincidence. There's, you know, ideological self-selection that goes on, and you know, happens, of course, in many other fields as well. You know, if you take the wrong position on legal issues or social issues, you know, you're not going to get a job at places like that.
Yeah, I could see that. And Hillsdale's always been really focused on academia and very focused on fact. So I would imagine that's a great spot for you.
Yes, I just joined about a year and a half ago, but it's been great. And it is, unfortunately, there are not many places left that actually, you know, are open-minded ideologically, which is, you know, also kind of ludicrous, because we hear so much about how universities must champion diversity, but it's not really the diversity of, you know, ways of thinking that they really want.
Yeah. If maybe put a plug in. Hillsdale is, I know they do some classes online, but I would imagine you have to go there in real life to actually do it, you know, finish your degree. I don't know.
The online classes are not degree granting, but there are, yeah, so the in residence classes are where the degrees happen, but there's some great online content happening there. And I should mention to you, since you're in California, I am going to be speaking at the Nixon Library later this month. And so we do sometimes get out to travel at main campuses in Michigan, and also have one in Washington, D.C.
Nice. How would people follow that? How would they know about that?
Go to the Nixon Foundation website. It's the information's all there.
Okay. All right. We'll post that for this show, because that's, I think, for people who have kind of known bits and pieces of this, you know, of the history here, it's really nice when somebody lays it all out and makes sense of it, and they can look at it and go, I thought that's what was going on.
Before we let you go, I got one thing.
Well, we're not letting him go yet.
No. what are some of the lessons that we should learn from this, from the war, and from in regards to our military and diplomatic policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is that the president needs to have a sound understanding of military affairs, because that person is the commander in chief, and they also need to pay attention to what the generals are saying. Now, the generals are not infallible, but they tend to know more. Almost always, they know more than the president. And you also need the Secretary of Defense, who is knows the military, because that was one of the big problems with Robert McNamara. He was an automotive industry executive who really didn't know too much about the military, and we find they consistently ignored sound military advice. So that was a big one. You know, another one is just the importance of explaining what's going on to the American people. I think, you know, especially, you know, we haven't sent troops to Ukraine, but we're now sending a lot of money, and I don't think that the leadership has done an adequate job of convincing Americans why we should be sending all this money over there when we have a lot of other things we could be doing with it.
Sure, sure. And I don't want to get you in trouble or anything, but what's your opinion of our current leadership at the top of the military and Pentagon and so forth? Do you think they're making the right moves?
Well, it's a bit hard to say because they have certain restrictions on what they can say. I do think, you know, the some of the promotion of woke ideology in the military we're seeing is very harmful, and they had, you know, spent all this time trying to countering extremism in the military, which, you know, they found out actually there was very little of it, but they had all these things and gave people the impression that there was only certain types of extremism that bothered them, and that you could be extreme in other ways. And so I think, you know, a lot of people in the military are not happy with how increasing in the military is being used for social engineering purposes.
Right, right.
Yeah, I'm sure that how long does something have to be in the rearview mirror before it's considered history? Like, for the purposes
of a book.
That's a good
question. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say about 50 years is a good period, which is about where we are with Vietnam. And, you know, 50 years out from 1973, and by that time you have more information that's become available, more archival sources are out there, and the people who are sort of most involved in it are either very old or they've passed on, and so you have people who were not really part of the event, like me, who are now spending a lot of time looking at it. And there is value, I think, at looking at things earlier, because oftentimes that's how we make decisions. And, you know, people only look back 10 or 20 years oftentimes. So it's worth looking at that. But I think in terms of, you know, the really high quality history, I think it is often 50 years or so later before we really get deeply into the nuts and bolts of what was happening.
Yeah, because I would think writing about this period, I hope you do an excellent job of chronicling it and put it in some kind of a capsule for somebody in the future. Because honestly, I've always thought anybody who looked back at this time would think that we were lying, you know? They're like, they certainly didn't do that. They didn't have they didn't have people pretending to be admirals that were men that were dressed in dresses and, you know, kind of like our kids now look back at, like, the MASH, you know, series with Klinger, you know, and his pearls and all that. And it was a joke. I mean, it was funny back then. And now, all of a sudden, that's all become real. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think history will be kind. Yeah. How about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that's going to be brutal, but I do think it would be fun to write about, I hope you get a chance to do that, or at least do the groundwork for it, because I think that it's a stunning tale that needs to be told so it never happens again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's having consequences right now, and I think
we're making decisions based on these things.
If we don't get it straightened out and start acting mm-hmm. like a military and not a big social engineering project.
What's your next project?
Well, I'm going to write the final volume of this Vietnam War trilogy, so it'll go the first volume, Triumph Forsaken, was 1954 to 1965, and then Triumph Regained is 1965 to 68, and the final volume will be from 1969 through 1975.
So of the three, I realize you've only written two out of the three, but which is the toughest for you to square up and make sense of?
This one, I mean, they've all required, you know, years of research. They've taken a long time, but I wanted to, it was necessary really to get to that depth. But this one, the new one's a little more grueling in that the Americans, once they are there in force, as they are during this volume, there's so much more written information out there. So you have to, if you want to be thorough, there's just so much reporting and interviews and documents and all of that. So it is, you know, very time consuming.
Well, we really appreciate that you're willing to spend the time to do that, because otherwise history is left to the craziness. And for all the people who served in the Vietnam era in that time period, and who serve in general in our military, you know, thank you for your service, and we're sorry that you were treated so poorly when you came home. There's just no going back on things like that, but writing an accurate history certainly helps. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Mark Moyer. His book is Triumph Regained. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Thank you.
Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. If you missed the first hour, you missed a good one. So that was on the history of the Vietnam War, kind of a view of history that we don't typically get. So I hope you do catch that. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. All the archives there are free, and just MP3 files. You can listen to them online. You can download them or do whatever you like with them. We are not particular about that. We do the show to benefit the public and do educational things, you know. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, what do you have for us today?
Well, let me tell you, Aaron. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer.
Got that out of our system.
Yeah. Pape will pretty much take care of you with anything regarding John Deere products. They can get everything from bicycles to big tractors. Says John Deere, give them a call. They'll get you fixed up. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, right between Oasis and I just forgot the other street. Pine Grove exits. So go up and see them, or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 226-9226, or you can catch them online at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's see. Sure, easy for me to say.
Sure.
Aaron with one eye. Yes, so... Our second hour, we have Ambassador Francis Rooney, former Ambassador Francis Rooney. But I think once you're an ambassador, you're always an ambassador. And he was a congressman, too. But then you're not always a congressman. So, I don't know. I think the ambassador title sticks. It's got, I think people like ambassadors more than they like members of Congress. So... I don't know if it's like, you know, one starts with A, one starts with C, go with the better letter.
No,
I don't know.
Who's yell at you when you're a congressman.
Apparently.
You know I mean? Yeah.
Probably get sick of that. So let's see. He's been on with us a bunch of times. I really should link all of his shows because we chat with him about some interesting stuff. He wrote a book called The Global Vatican, and super interesting book. And he is an American politician. I guess you should be American if you're going to be a politician in our country. And a diplomat. Who was the U.S. representative for Florida's 19th congressional district from 2017 to 2021 during the interesting time. In the Republican caucus, he served as a United States ambassador to the Holy See under George W. Bush from 2005 to 2008. That is worthy of discussion, and he's the chairman of Rooney Holdings. The one thing that we've never talked to him about, though, he serves as a member of the advisory board of the Panama Canal Authority, and he's a member of the Council of American Ambassadors, also interesting, but he's a trustee of the Center for Study of the Presidency in Congress. You know, that seems like something we should know more about. He's a graduate of Georgetown and Georgetown University Law Center, also has honorary degrees from Notre Dame and the University of Dallas.
Hmm.
Ta-da!
Yeah, there you go.
So
he's been around.
He has been around.
Yeah.
And hanging out in Florida. You still hanging out in Florida, Ambassador? Because it's good to call you Ambassador, but you can't call people former congressmen, right? That's kind of weird.
You know, I think congressman's kind of a pejorative term right now.
I know. That's what I was saying. Like, you know, I think being an ambassador, it's like that has a little more rank.
A little more wild factor.
Or maybe it's less rank. I don't know. depends on how you look at it. Okay, so we didn't have, we did have, you posted your opinion contribution here in The Hill, midterms 2022, lessons learned in the path forward. So we probably ought to hit that a little bit. And I'm hoping that you'll tell us a little bit about the Center for Study of the Presidency in Congress and maybe what you guys are looking at for the, I don't know, the future as is informed by the past, I suppose.
Sure.
All right, so fire away. You just take us wherever you want to go.
The Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress. I'm not a trustee anymore. I got off when I ran for Congress.
Ah.
It was founded by David Abshire, who was the ambassador to NATO under Reagan and came back to help manage the Iran-Contra controversy for Reagan.
Ooh.
And if Dave hadn't done such a masterful job, who knows what would have happened to Reagan, because the Democrats were out for him and there was some pretty conflicting evidence about using money to Iranian money to arm Contras in Nicaragua and stuff. But David Abshire did a masterful job of protecting the president.
Nice. And that's why it was formed?
Well, it was a think tank in New York, and Dave got a hold of it and moved it to D.C. And so they do the usual think tank stuff. They do studies about, you know, we did a lot of studies about Afghanistan and Iraq in the day. They do studies about military preparedness, economic stuff, small business stuff. There's several State Department people that are on the board, several corporate people, Steve Schwarzman, et cetera, that are on the board. And it's a nice cross-section of leadership. Mike Rogers, you know, used to be head of the Intel Committee in the Congress. He's on the board. A good group.
Nice. And so do they put out information? Is it basically inside stuff that they, you know, that they help people in office with, or is it stuff that's available to the public?
Yeah, all these think tanks put out information to try to help guide public opinion and policy for the elected officials, for corporate leaders, for anybody that wants to read it and have their view of different subjects.
Hmm.
And they can inform opinions that way.
Well, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, you wouldn't want to have all this brain trust and then just let it. But a lot of times it's formed for a particular thing, and you're informing a particular audience.
Well, let's face it, when people get elected to Congress, they're not experts in everything. I mean, I'm sure they have a particular specialty, but in most cases, they have a lot to learn. They have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of those members of Congress aren't experts in anything.
Well, I didn't want to go there.
Hey, that's not what George Santos says.
Well, he's an expert in everything that's fraudulent.
He's an expert in things that we haven't even thought of yet. That's just so bizarre. Our first hour was...
How did the people of that district elect that fraud?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Are they all brain dead up there?
Well, you know, it's called not doing your homework, yeah. I guess.
Well,
you know,
sometimes. And continue to support him. I mean, after the fact, it's...
Well, they wanted Congress itself to get rid of him, but that's not their job. I mean, that's not that they don't get to unseat people that other people have elected. But yeah, I don't know.
The Republicans were kind of conflicted because they don't want to lose the Republican seat. It's almost a fluke that a Republican won't want it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And
there is that.
Majority.
Well, it's very. It's tricky. I always wonder what it'd be like to live in a district like that. You know, nobody really talks to the people who live there, and I don't know if they're maybe they're just chronically unavailable for interviews. But
well, it's true with a lot of the electeds.
I'd be curious what they were told.
How they get elected. I mean, could their constituents really be that out of touch to elect some of these people? But they get reelected. So I mean,
Fetterman.
California is a great example. I mean,
yeah, we've elected some doozies, and we're getting ready.
Well, McCormick would have beat Fetterman hands down had Trump not got in there and pushed that Haas guy.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous. Trump has cost us so many Republican seats several times in Georgia and now in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that was kind of the first line. That was the opening salvo in your op-ed. Now that the midterms are over, it's time for the Republican Party to come to terms with two key concepts. First, the narrative of this is Donald Trump's party should be laid to rest, and second, the Americans want representatives in office that will be pragmatic and deliver results and not a bunch of empty rhetoric. So, all crazy people and liars aside, yeah, I do think that is something that people really want. It's like, please go there and do real things that actually help me.
Yeah, and as a party, you know, we've got to have something to sell. We can't sell these dumb candidates like Trump put in there. In the House, there were several House districts where there were crazy Trump candidates that had no chance of winning and, in fact, did not win.
Yeah.
We should have had a 10-15 seat majority.
Yeah, and everybody's got their opinions, so you wrote an op-ed, you've got opinions. So why do you think that is? Why do you think that
we fell so short of
Yeah, well, I mean, why do you think he would push people that they didn't think would really be able to win?
Because Trump doesn't care if they win. Trump cares if they agree with him.
Well, I guess I wouldn't.
He said that.
Yeah, that's true.
He doesn't look out for anybody but him.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, if he's going to run again, how does that serve his interest?
Well, I guess it would serve him better if the people had won. But now that they've lost, I don't think it helps him at all.
Right.
I think his star is fading right now.
Well, he certainly hasn't been really campaigning as hard as he was, as hard as he did the first time around, and maybe he's just holding back until it gets a little closer to the election. But he still has a fairly large following. I mean, when you look at the polls, I mean, he's still way up there in the polls, and I just wonder if anybody with any substance will be able to stand a chance to run against him.
Well, he is up there in the polls, and he's not. He is there in the polls with his hardcore group, and that's actually declined a little bit. But I don't think he can. It's kind of like a hard deck. I don't think he can get above it, mm-hmm. and that's the problem. So he did fine against a scoundrel like Hillary Clinton, but you get this Biden guy out there that people say, well, you know, people, we didn't. I don't think we really realized how senile he was, but. You know, he wasn't as objectionable as Hillary Clinton, and I think a lot of people went for him that would have gone for Trump the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the first time, Trump had no record, and now he does,
mm-hmm.
including January 6th.
Yeah, and now that's all coming out for a revisit. So, by way of opinion, you think that the footage, the Capitol footage should have come out a long time ago or waited?
Yeah, I don't know why they should get it all out there right away.
Yeah, that never made sense to me either. Other than it didn't really, I mean, if you can't cherry pick things and use them, if everybody's going to look at everything, that kind of makes it a little harder. Do you think they
I think the people should see it all. See it all. See, they can make their own judgments.
Sure.
Well, that's the way it used to be, but it seems like we've become so divided anymore that nobody trusts either side with the information that comes out. So I think the only right way to do it, and like say the way it's always been done, is you put all your cards on the table and then let the American people decide. And
exactly.
That just hasn't been done these last few years. From both sides. I mean, it's everything is skewed, and I think it's going to be a long road for the American people to get back to a point where they can trust their government with, and the media, I think, is even got a longer road to hoe there. Their credibility is completely shot.
They've had a little prevarication problem as well.
Yeah.
Well, the media's gotten so partisan. You know, we're so far away from journalism.
Oh, yeah.
It's advocacy. Traditional partisan advocacy on the part of our media.
Yeah.
And that's really not what we expect from them.
No, it's not. Everything is opinion and entertainment now. It's not news anymore. It's you like you say, you cherry pick the facts that work for your side and. And then, push your agenda.
Yeah. And that's created this huge increase in partisanship. I think it's augmented the partisanship that's probably there anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you combine that with all these districts that are R plus 12 or 15 or D plus 12 or 15 where the election's decided in the primary, combine partisan media with that, you've got kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah. Well, and that's the, I don't know, and that's the drama that we're headed into. I really am looking to kind of pick your brain on where you think we're headed because it seems like a long way out to 2024, but it really isn't, especially in...
No, it's going to come pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to declare in, like, September, October. Our guest is former Ambassador Francis Rooney, and we're going to have to come back in a couple of minutes here. Got to take a little break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
And that is where we find ourselves. So, all right. You have a lot of people who are who find it to be heresy that you would say anything against Donald Trump. So you can't, you're not allowed to do that. But we do have a lot of people who are, consider themselves Republicans, who have either were never in his camp or have left his camp, and still consider themselves Republicans. So demonizing them and telling them they're not good enough Republicans doesn't seem like a very winning strategy. Compromise seems to be a dirty word. In your article, you talk about DeSantis and Youngkin winning over majorities in the Republican base, but also pulling in independents and some Democrats. So Well, go there. Where do you see that going? I mean, do you think it just becomes two Republican camps, and that way we never get anywhere?
No, I'm going to be optimistic that we will get somebody running, whether it's DeSantis or Glenn Youngkin or who, that can bridge the gap and will not be repugnant to more traditional, middle-of-the-road, pro-business Republicans, but will also be able to excite the base. And that's kind of the delicate tightrope that our candidates need to walk.
Yeah, it definitely is. So what happens, you know, it's still kind of up in the air whether DeSantis is going to run. I think he'd make a great candidate. But what happens if Trump gets the nomination? At that point, do you think the party has a chance of ever bringing the Senate and the House back into...
I mean, does everybody just get on board and go, okay, well, wasn't our choice, but he's our candidate? And
well, that's what's happened in the last couple of elections. It's not who you want to see. It's hold your nose and vote for the guy that we've nominated.
And that worked against Hillary Clinton because she was so odious, highest negatives of any Republican or any candidate ever.
Yeah.
But it might not work against anybody else. It didn't work against Biden.
No.
And there's a limit, I think, to what Trump can get people to do if there's any kind of alternative.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be a tough decision. I mean, if we don't get a candidate in there that everybody can rally around, I think we're going to be in for another 4 years of disaster. And I think people need to realize that we really do need a change. And we got a change with Trump. And, you know, I don't agree with a lot of the things he said and a lot of the way he did a lot of
things. Just the way he did it. But his policy,
I mean,
where are you with his policy for the most part? Like, how about foreign policy?
Oh, yeah, I think foreign policy, I'm a little more conflicted about him. But in the domestic stuff, it was such low-hanging fruit, any Republican would have done the same stuff, getting rid of all that Obama anti-business stuff that we worked on in the first 2 years I was up there. It was a no-brainer.
Right. And it had a big impact on the economy, on jobs, on a lot of stuff.
It did. But unfortunately, because of the 60-vote thing in the Senate, it couldn't be made into law.
Right.
It was all by executive order.
Yep.
The House would pass it, but the Senate wouldn't bring it up. So Trump would do an executive order, which makes it replaceable.
Yep.
And now Biden's doing all that.
Yeah, and we're
kind of like a banana republic. We swing each way.
Well, and we've talked about that a bunch of times, that when you do the executive orders, it's like you've written fake laws in pencil, and the next guy shows up with a giant eraser and away it goes. The other thing we've talked about before is that the executive order thing has become the de facto legislative tool for presidents who can't get Congress to go along with whatever it is they want on both sides. So it would seem that, I guess that's where the the Center for the Presidency that you were part of, I was curious, have they ever taken up the idea that potentially like Congress needs to sue the executive branch so that it goes over to the Supreme Court and they have to figure out constitutionally what they can do with executive order and what they can't and put limits on that.
Well, I think they've already got that, don't they?
Not really, no.
Yeah, at times the center's done some work on that, but getting Congress to do anything is like pulling teeth.
Well, at any given time, on a deal like that, the biggest problem is at any given time, their person is in the is running the executive branch, and so they don't want to upset the apple cart for what they see as winning. The bad part is then the giant eraser comes, and then the other guy's doing the winning, kind of. But it's temporary, so the swings seem to be getting more more pronounced.
Yeah, like I say, I don't think we're much different than El Salvador, okay? You get one guy in, he does what he wants to do. You get another guy in, he does what he wants to do. Swings back and forth. It's yin and yang.
So,
and none of them in the executive branch seem to pay attention to the law.
Right.
I mean, Biden joked that the tuition relief and the rent relief were probably unconstitutional, but he said, I'll do it anyway and fight it out in the courts. Now, what kind of leadership is that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you know going into it, it's not gonna pass muster. It's ridiculous that they go ahead and do it anyway. And I think it's just PR. I think they're just doing it because you know,
it's all messaging. If in fact they were to tighten up the executive order, I don't know, process, abilities, whatever you want to call it, how much do you think that would help?
Well, if you could do it, it would help a lot.
Yeah, I would think
so,
too.
Congress would just pass real laws that were specific and enforceable and didn't leave all this leeway to the bureaucrats. That would go a long way to solve the problem, but they don't.
I think they have good laws. They have some good laws on the book, but when you have an executive branch and a Justice Department that are in cahoots and don't want to enforce the laws,
that's always interesting.
You know, that's a problem.
That is a problem, and that's a new problem. The things that we've heard out of the Obama and Biden administrations about ignoring the rule of law, DACA, DAPA, rent relief, tuition loan relief, this is unprecedented.
Yeah.
In a country that's supposed to be a country of laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I there was one in our district here because we have so many water issues and so much overreach with the agencies, Army Corps and Reclamation and all of them. And so there was an amendment put in that was actually signed under Obama, and the entire thing said that the Army Corps of Engineers could not regulate ongoing farming practices. It was one sentence long, fairly straightforward too, and that was added to something, whatever it was, passed. And when the Army Corps was called on it, they said that's not the way we read that. Like we said, hey, you can't jack up the constituent over this. The guy actually is John Duarte, who is now a member of Congress, which is sort of funny. I'm sure he's going to explain that to them himself now. But it actually primed him to run. But when they went to him with it and said, here, what about this? They said, that's not the way we read that.
And it stood.
That's the executive branch for you. They're power in themselves. We really are not the democracy we think we are. We are really in a dictatorship of the executive branch.
Yeah, so if since we're talking dictatorships, let's go monarchy. If you were king for a day, how would you fix it?
I would do a few things. I would, first of all, impose term limits. Nobody serves more than 12 years. Go back to your real world. Two, I would somehow or another, even if you make all districts square, I would get rid of highly partisan districts on both sides. At the end of the Clinton administration, 26% of congressional districts were considered highly partisan. Now it's 80, and I think that's part of our cancer. The elections are all decided in the primaries, which drive everybody out to the lunatic fringe. And the third thing I would do, if we could figure out how to do it, would be to reinsert the fairness doctrine where media had to present both sides of political issues. Remember the fairness doctrine?
No.
Roger Ailes got it taken away under Reagan's administration.
Hmm. What do you do about the entrenched bureaucrats that come along? You have an election, you get new people, and then you have this bureaucracy in place that is pretty much ruling the roost. I mean, do you put term limits on that?
Well, there's one more thing I could throw in there that I didn't think about, the Chevron Doctrine. The Chevron Doctrine was a Supreme Court case years ago that decided that when there's vagueness in a law, the bureaucracy can interpret it. I'd get rid of that thing. I would say if there's vagueness in a law, it goes back to Congress to figure it out. It's their law,
mm-hmm.
not the bureaucrats.
Yeah, there's so much stuff in our society today that's being dictated by bureaucrats. You know, they can't impose a tax unless it's voted on, so they call it a fee, and then they get their money anyway. I mean, there's just little things like that that people are just fed up with, and we've got to make a change in some of these bureaucracies. And I think if we had the right person in the executive office or in the presidency, he could get rid of the heads of a lot of these departments and start making a change, but you still have all the people underneath them. And
they're there for 30 years. There's no term limit there.
And Trump was a classic example of that. He got killed by the bureaucracies.
The only answer is to write tight laws that don't leave a lot of room for them to have discretion so that they can be pinned back.
Mm-hmm.
But Congress doesn't like to do that because it's hard to pass a really clear, tight law. It's easy to pass a vague one where different people can have different ideas of what it means.
So go back to my example. The Army Corps of Engineers cannot regulate ongoing farming practices, period, the end. This guy was planting wheat in a field that had had wheat for over 100 years. Obviously, ongoing farming. It was not a wetlands. But they decided that the little furrows where he was going to put seeds that had filled up with rain were now under waters of the U.S. and were a wetlands. And so, I mean, that was a really tight direction. There was no wiggle room to that. But then when they basically thumb their nose at you, as a member of Congress, what's your out there?
Well, part of the problem there is the waters of the U.S. law.
Yes.
And that was the most ridiculous thing in the world. I mean, Trump rescinded it by executive action, but we couldn't get it rescinded in a law. But to say that those furrows, some rain pond in your backyard, if it can leak out into a navigable waterway, is regulated by the Corps of Engineers, it's kind of patently ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of open to some abuse, maybe, just possibly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, could have some problems. Yeah, it. Honestly, I do think that the executive order issue, if you could, you know, if they could tighten that up, do you think Congress can't tighten it up because it's a different branch of government, but the Supreme Court could certainly mitigate how that's being handled based on the constitutionality, couldn't they?
Yeah, they could. The Supreme Court could rule it unconstitutional, and then maybe the Congress could pass a better law.
Yeah, so how do you get there from here, like the way we're situated now?
Right now, the only good thing that's happened in the whole government is the Supreme Court.
Yeah, true. So on a deal like that, how do you get it there?
The Supreme Court rules it unconstitutional, and maybe the Republican House passes a better law. And it sits there, and someday maybe we get a Senate that can also do it. I don't know. But this Senate's not going to do anything.
Mm-mm. No. No, and that's, I don't know, maybe the good thing and the bad thing. They got a lot of bad ideas. We've got a lot of good ideas coming out of the House at the moment, but, yeah, now they're going to be hamstrung. And it was supposed to be difficult. I get that. The setup was such that, you know, we weren't going to be, you know, legislating like a house on fire, because obviously every time we pass laws, our liberty slips a little bit for the most part.
But yeah, it's slipping a lot lately.
Yeah. Yeah, there are times when it slips more than other times. Got to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's go back to the unpleasantness. And I want to see where you think that the Trump influence on 2024, what, you know, I mean, obviously nobody has a crystal ball that I know of, but I'd be curious to see where you see that influence and how it can be mitigated going forward. So our discussion is with Ambassador Francis Rooney, former Ambassador Francis Rooney, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's a treacherous game.
A sucker for these lies, but I know when an angel is the devil in disguise. This is war.
This is war. I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing.
Well, the upside down part was right, but I think the love thing was a little off track.
It reminds me of my childhood because I watched Curious George, and all of the music on Curious George was Jack Johnson. So I'm like, it's like I'm 6 years old.
Well, it's only fitting that we would be playing Curious George songs when we're talking about Congress. That kind of fits, actually. I didn't even know that either. Okay, so where do you think we're going to go with this, you know, Trump's great, Trump's horrible thing that we have?
I'm hopeful that
looming. We're
going to have a couple of strong candidates like Governor DeSantis, Governor Youngkin, Governor Abbott, Governor Neim, who are going to get out, and Ambassador Haley. They're going to get out there and start campaigning and show the American people that there's an alternative to Trump in the Republican side of things.
And so that being the case, I agree 100%. Who do you think they'd have to run against? I mean, I don't think Biden's going to run again. I can't imagine that people would sit still for another 4 years of this. But who knows? Crazier things have happened.
The only way they will if they can't figure out how to get rid of Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Yeah, can you imagine? Well, and they're thinking
nobody
about...
Nobody likes her. The Democrats don't like her any more than we do.
Right.
No, and they never did.
So who do you think would be a good candidate on the Democrat side? I mean, as far as somebody we would have to be concerned about if Trump doesn't get the nomination?
Oh, that's a good question, because they've become so polar on the extremes. Biden appealed because he had a history of being a moderate, even though he hasn't acted that way since he got elected. I don't know what moderate Democrats there might be. But I don't know any moderate Democrats.
Are there any
moderate Democrats there?
No, not really.
I don't.
But, I mean, they keep talking about, like, Gavin Newsom. Okay, so you live in Florida.
He's not about moderate Democrat.
No,
he's definitely not.
No,
moderate.
But they keep talking about running him. Okay, even in Florida, you know the crazy stuff he's doing, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
lunatic asylum out there.
I know.
Oh, we see it and hear it every day. It's amazing.
The only thing that makes California look good is Oregon.
Yeah, and they're trying to split part of their state off and give it to Idaho.
Okay, you want to hear something funny? I was talking to a guy yesterday who moved to the Brookings area, so the coast of Oregon, out of California. And people in Oregon are blaming all their problems on California. They wouldn't have all these problems if California wasn't doing whatever. And I'm laughing. I'm like,
That's always been their line, though. I mean, California has always been their big problem, their big influence, but they've got their own problems.
Yeah, I know. They legalized mushrooms, for God's sake. Yeah, what could go wrong?
Last week, the Wall Street Journal had an article and a Pareto chart graphing the reduction or elimination of cash bail and the increase in crime. Now, why do you need to even make a chart about that? It's obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the chart data backs it up. It's all in Oregon and California.
Yeah. And you know the thing that's interesting is we have so many people in California. So the danger is with all of this is that it all seems hopeless. It all seems like it's never getting fixed. It's all right. And then people just say, well, it doesn't matter. So there's voter fraud. There's this. There's that. The candidates aren't great. I don't know who to believe. Everybody lies to me. The media is bad. I'm not going to vote.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
So okay, what would be, you know, if you had 100 of them sitting in front of you who all gave you that thing and they're like, okay, so convince me otherwise, what would be your elevator speech on that one?
Well, I would say if you want to have a voice, you got to vote. And it's better if you have a voice that you speak up and do other things than just vote. And you have to recruit candidates who don't agree with all these wackos. And they need to be funded so they can get on the air and make their point.
Yeah. Yeah, and people want to believe that you don't need to finance any of this, but I don't know, like in a state like California and Florida and places that are big and have a lot of geography, it takes a tremendous amount to reach people. You know, you can't physically go to everybody's house, but
large media markets, it's very expensive.
It's super expensive. Yep, and especially in our rural areas, a lot of our media has kind of gone away. You no longer have the regular local newspaper. It all comes out of St. Louis or Chicago or whatever.
Dallas, Fort Worth.
But people aren't taking the paper. That's the thing. Like in our small communities, those papers that have been taken over by Scripps and whatnot. People aren't subscribing because it doesn't have any local news in it. So
we have that here.
Now you can't reach them.
That here in Naples, if you want to find out what's going on in Atlanta or Orlando, just read the Naples paper.
Yeah.
Because Gannett has consolidated all their back office, like in Tampa or somewhere, and they print every paper that they own in Florida, which is a lot, in one place, and then email the files and they print it off locally, you know?
Yeah, see, and so reaching people with that. The other thing, I don't know about other states, but I'm assuming if they have neighboring markets, like I know in Northern California, their television market comes out of Oregon, and in Eastern California, the northern part anyway, theirs comes out of Reno. So if you have candidates running in California, now they're having to buy media time in other states to get into their own district. It's expensive. I mean, to think that running for office, you can just do it on your, you know, your...
Yeah, you've got to have some major backing.
On your moxie.
In like, the millions.
Yeah, no. It's... So, all right, contributions to the big political machine, the local political machine, candidate direct.
Well, every candidate is going to have his campaign committee and his fundraising effort,
mm-hmm.
and that's the best way to do it, because then if you believe in the candidate, they're going to spend the money to get that guy elected,
right?
Not conflicted with ideology or pushing gun control or non-gun control or any other crazy thing that someone might want to spend their money pushing.
And then the races that are kind of crossovers where they cannot raise enough money in their own district to actually keep either hold the seat or take the seat, and they're relying on state GOP or the Republican National Committee. Have you had experience with them?
Oh, yeah. The National Republican Campaign Committee, they fund a lot of candidates. They did a good job this year. Unfortunately, the candidates weren't effective. They wasted a lot of money. because these Trump guys weren't going to win.
Yeah, and you know, in your estimation, why is that?
Why wouldn't they win?
Yeah, like so for people that are like, that's not true. What would be the case
Those
you would make
don't
to
believe that the election was stolen?
Okay,
and as long as these clowns keep going out and saying that, they're not going to move the ball down the field.
Yeah, they have to get off that and start a new strategy, like get some decent candidates that people can rally behind.
Yeah, I mean, how about debt and spending? How about immigration reform? How about dealing responsibly with China? How about building ships? We spend half of the money that the entire world spends on defense, and we don't have enough money in our deal to build any ships?
Yeah.
It's all going to people and politically located bases and politically correct stuff. And we're going to be building ships and show those Chinese we mean business.
Yeah, so let's talk about foreign policy a little bit. You mentioned one of the striking comments you made in here that surprised the heck out of me was 77% of those ages 17 to 24 will not qualify for the military. What's that?
Yeah, it's right in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. And why is that? Is it just drugs?
Because they're out of shape.
Just out of
shape. They're either too dumb, mentally infirm, or physically infirm, or some combination thereof.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a huge problem right there. And when you look at what's happening as far as our budget goes, what we spend on our military versus what China and Russia and some of the other players, what they're investing in, and they're actually getting results. I mean, they're building, they're
China
building ships.
One third of what we spend, and they're actually building more ships.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that? Well, they get to just tell their guys what to do. They don't really have to pay them that much, I guess.
Well, no, they also only do what's important, not what's politically needed. Look at all the bases we have around the country in stupid places that are not strategic.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last straw for me was after Hurricane Mike wiped out Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida. We should have said, thank you, Hurricane Mike. Instead, they're going to spend billions to rebuild a base that is totally unnecessary, is too small to land anything important on it, and is 50 miles east of Eglin Field, one of the largest bases that we have. And that happens all the time around here. And how about Germany, where we have hundreds of thousands of troops, and we've had them there since World War II, and what have they done?
Right.
We must have the most highly polished equipment in the world over there.
Yeah, I've always wondered about the whole Germany thing. I mean, I understand, you know, we had a Cold War and we needed troops over there at one point, but that hasn't been the case for a long time. And our presence over there is huge, and it's got to be costing in the billions of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands of troops, and an awful lot of them in Italy, too, and there's nothing to fight.
Right.
At least in Spain, at Rota, we have some ships that can go down there and patrol the West African coast. But the ones in Germany and Italy, what are they going to do?
Yeah. Well, with this thing with Russia heating up, it might make a case for troops in Germany, but I don't know that they're equipped to really deter a Russian-type invasion, are they?
Well, and look at NATO. Where's NATO?
Right.
Belgium.
Yeah.
If you could reorganize things in an appropriate manner to put assets where they need to be close to the action, you'd move NATO to Poland or something.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to give up the pastries. and you'd get rid of Ramstein in Germany and probably Aviano in Italy. And move all those bases out to Hungary and Poland and Slovakia and all that kind of stuff, where the action is.
And do you think the NATO allies would be receptive to us moving huge bases like that onto different territories?
No.
I was going to say.
The payroll. Germany loves the payroll. They've got a couple hundred thousand people over there eating, drinking, living, supporting the German economy.
But with regular paychecks.
Job?
Sure.
Yeah, that's not our job.
Right.
There's taxpayer money there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's...
And in Aviano in Italy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a major issue there. As far as the NATO allies that don't have bases, do you think they would be receptive to putting bases? Because, I mean, shoot, we've run into, like, during the Iraq War, I mean, even France didn't want to be hosting anything or even let us fly over their territory during that conflict.
Yeah, that's because Chirac didn't want to do the war in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out he was right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that Poland would be more than glad. Lithuania and some of those countries would be more than glad to have some U.S. troops over there.
Mm-hmm.
Might make them sleep better at night.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. But, no, I agree. I think we've got assets in areas that, I mean, if anything did happen, they would have to be relocated, and that's not an easy task. And you know, that alone would set back any kind of a defensive action, probably by months, just moving assets to where they're needed.
Yeah, I'm afraid that we have more of a political military than people might imagine.
Yeah, I think that would not be a hard sell. We are in the last 10 seconds, believe it or not. Ambassador Rennie, thanks for hanging out with us. We enjoy discussing things with you. Anytime we can. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you very much.
It's been Ambassador Francis Rennie. You've been listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.